Did you know that your gut is directly connected to your brain and can contribute to anxiety, stress, and depression, which, by the way, can also impact your sexual health? So here's my secret weapon for gut health, Just Thrive Probiotic. Now listen up. Just Thrive isn't just any ordinary probiotic. It is the only one that survives your stomach acid and reaches your gut 100% alive. All those others, the ones that come in fancy drinks or you gotta refrigerate, nope, that's not even a thing. This is the one. I've noticed significant changes to my overall health. Like, this might be TMI, but I'm way more regular and my skin is glowing. Think of Just Thrive like your personal gut gardener. It maintains the health of your gut by weeding out the bad bacteria that causes all those digestive issues and then replenishes the good, making it a total game changer for your digestion, your immune system, your skin, even your mood and sexual health. And if you want to check out my episode with Just Thrive's founder, Tina Anderson, we talk all about how gut bacteria plays a crucial role in your overall happiness, including your sex life. Because a healthy, balanced gut means less stress and more energy. So if you want to check it out, I'm offering a deal for my listeners. You can save 20% off site-wide at justthrivehealth.com with the promo code SEXWITHEMILY. That's 20% off on the probiotic that's truly changing lives and making waves in the wellness community. Everyone's talking about it. Don't just take my word for it. Try it for yourself. Go to justthrivehealth.com. Use promo code SEXWITHEMILY for 20% off. So for a week, when you are thinking of criticizing them, just try to switch it. And you can even pre-write at the top of the week. These are the 10 things I want to say to them. Because that's going to rewire your brain too. But not only it's going to rewire your way of looking at your partner, but it's all connected. You actually felt good in the moment. And by voicing that and praising your partner for that or sharing your experience, you're going to get more of that rather than the blaming and shaming, which gets you nowhere.
You know, you have to be obvious about your love. You can't be vague about it. And you can't be sitting there like hoping that someone will step up and love you the way you want to be loved.
You're listening to Sex with Emily. I'm Dr. Emily, and I'm here to help you prioritize your pleasure and liberate the conversation around sex. When you keep running into the same relationship or sex problems over and over and over again, what's the one common denominator? Brace yourself, because it's you. You're the thing that carries over from partnership to partnership, which is why Gary Bishop, author of the crazy bestseller, Unfuck Yourself, decided to write a new book, a tough love spin on self-help. It's called Love Unfucked, Getting Your Relationship Shit Together. And I invited him to chat with me about it. In this interview, Gary and I talk about how to become aware of our destructive relationship habits and concrete, very specific ways to manage them. He tells me the one simple change he made with his current partner that transformed their relationship. And we go deep on feeling threatened, the fight or flight response that inhibits emotional intimacy, not to mention our best sex. But we also talk about the hopeful side of radical self-awareness and the opportunity in front of us when we step outside of ourselves, look at our patterns, and change them to create room for the pleasurable connections we all want. Intentions with Emily. For each episode, I want to start off by setting an intention for the show. I do it, and I encourage you to do the same. What do you want to get out of this episode? Well, my intention was just to help you become more self-aware in a really simple way so you can discover any of your unconscious interpersonal tendencies and start to take steps to evolve them so you can have the beautiful relationships and sex you deserve. We all deserve it. Please rate and review Sex with Emily wherever you listen to the show. Also, my article, Ask Emily, How Do You Get Your Partner to Go to Therapy, is up at sexwithemily.com. Check out my YouTube channel for more sex tips and advice. If you want to ask me a question, just call my hotline, 559-TALK-SEX or 559-825-5739. Leave me your questions or message me at sexwithemily.com/askemily. Always include your name, your age, where you live, and how you listen to the show. Oh, you can change your name or choose to remain anonymous. Totally cool with that. All right, everyone, enjoy this episode. Gary John Bishop is the New York Times bestselling author of the self-empowerment classic, Unfuck Yourself, Get Out of Your Head and Into Your Life. His no-nonsense, tough-love approach to life mastery is the foundation for all of his books, including his latest, Love Unfucked, Getting Your Relationship Shit Together. Gary's urban philosophy has impacted millions worldwide through his talks, his podcast, Unfuck Nation, and of course, his wildly popular guides. In his new book, he explains what makes relationships work. You taking responsibility to fix yourself. Find more Gary at GaryJohnBishop.com, on Twitter and Instagram at GaryJohnBishop. Welcome to the show. Congratulations on your new book. And in your new book, you say that the missing piece required in all successful relationships is ourselves. So can you tell me what you mean by that?
In the pursuit of a great relationship, it's very much about finding the one, the right partner, the right kind of situation for ourselves. But in my experience, and this is what I really get into in the book, is we're not really clear on who's getting into this thing. And so what we're out to uncover in this new book is for you to finally come to terms with what's actually functioning in your relationship, right? Like what's actually coming at the table, because whether we like it or not, you know, we're not a blank slate. We don't walk into relationships, you know, kind of burden-free and without any views or opinions or ideals of how we think this should or shouldn't go.
So it's your way of saying enough of you blaming everyone else. You are the problem, essentially.
Right. I mean, it can be you're the problem. As long as you're not kind of relating to that from a perspective of like blame, it's really not about who's to blame. It's really more to get to the bottom of what's playing out here that maybe I hadn't considered. And that's often the surprising and the difficult work to undertake.
I would say, yes, it's the hardest work to undertake. And it's the last thing that we all want to do, right? It's the very last work to blame others, to see that we just haven't found the right person, they're flawed, and to never say, oh, maybe I have a part in this, perhaps.
Another surprising part for people is often we get into these situations where we're saying, well, maybe I'm just attracting the wrong kind of people or the wrong. And there's no attraction at play. You're actively, whether you're aware of it or not, you're actively looking for something that your, if you like, persona can play against. Unless you do that work, unless you kind of dig into the background and start to get, like, what am I bringing to the table when it comes to relationships, it'll always be running you. You'll never have the opportunity to really run the show yourself.
Hmm. Are you saying that perhaps when we often say like this person wasn't right and I can't find the right person or I keep attracting the wrong people, that might be a wake-up call as well? Let's go inward.
In all of your relationships that didn't work, there was one common denominator.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be, I think it'd be a bit silly to kind of ignore that, like how that's playing out.
I love what you say in the book about being addicted to being right. This might be one of the things that's keeping us from being in a healthy relationship. Can you talk more about that addiction?
Yeah. And it's weird how like it really is like an addiction. Like we can't stop ourselves like opening our mouths and saying that thing that we know if we say this thing, this is not going to go well, but what the heck, out it comes anyway. We fail to see that the kind of impact, like how that plays out in your relationship, you know, because when you get dug in about something and really dug in about being right, someone else must be wrong. And in that equation, if that's the person you love or that you say you love, then that's now a barrier to this thing called the loving relationship.
And I think when people are hearing this, addicted to being right, maybe they're thinking, and you could tell me more, Gary, about these reactions, but I hear people going, but I am always right. And everyone else is always wrong. And everyone else is stupid. And I hear people doing this at work. Like if you're always the one that's right at work, you're probably carrying this into your relationships as well. So you must get a lot of protest from this. Like what are some, it takes a while to get there.
Yeah, I do. But ultimately I ask them the same question. How's that working out for you?
Mm-hmm.
And you'll get the same answer. And in the background of that desire to be right is obviously the avoidance of somehow being perceived as wrong. There's a way that things should go and there's a way that things shouldn't go. And you need to be a certain way, and this needs to be a certain way, and this is what I want, and this is all of it. Ultimately, becomes very positional. It leaves you very polarized. You end up stuck. You end up stuck not only with what you've got, but what you see they have. And it's never, ever, ever a recipe for a relationship that actually works. I'm not even talking about a fairy tale relationship. I'm actually talking about one that fundamentally works.
And it doesn't even work in the workplace, let me just say. It really doesn't, because it's a work, it's collaboration. It is not everything is so black and white. Along the same vein, you talk about self-responsibility and self-awareness, and that's your whole thing. So I know you ask readers, how are you managing your own destructive traits? What have you put in place so you can powerfully manage your own hooks and triggers and self-sabotaging ways? But my question is this, Gary, what are some concrete ways that we can manage our bad patterns and traits once we've identified them?
What I get into a little later in the book is I say, notice that when you do get hooked or you do get triggered, or you do get caught up in something, you're following a pathway. And you can really go down that pathway. You can really go all the way down into the darkness with that stuff and into a relationship, or at least days or weeks or months of unworkability. You've got to kind of get yourself pulled back from that from time to time. You got to be aware enough that you realize where this is going for you. And you got to get reconnected to something else. Something like what? Well, if you are committed to having a loving relationship or a passionate relationship or a relationship of adventure, a relationship of discovery and exploring one another, then you need to get yourself back to handling your relationship through that lens. So to say, well, if I'm committed to loving this person and I say I'm committed to having love in this relationship with this person, then in what way does my self-sabotage or my self-destruction tie in with that? Well, it doesn't. And so it really is those moments where you're saying to yourself, no, I choose to have love in my life. And that includes stepping forward right now. And maybe I own something. Maybe I take responsibility for something. Maybe I say, you know what? You know, instead of this, I'm going to do this with this person. And it really is about getting yourself back in touch with fundamentally as a human being, what it is matters to you, resonates for you. And that'll keep you aligned with the life and the relationship you say you're really after.
Yeah. What are some helpful ways? I mean, I always talk about journaling or having affirmations and just getting clear, having therapy helps. What have you seen help or what has worked for you?
I operate out of this weird old-fashioned thing called integrity and doing and being who I said I would be. And I don't always feel that way. I don't always feel like I want to be loving today. But that is the kind of relationship that I want. And so a thing that really caused a significant breakthrough in my relationship actually many years ago was when I actually stopped expecting my wife to be on the hook for having love in a relationship. Like I kind of took it off the table for her. Like, I don't need you to be anyway. If you're just yourself, that's fine. There was this kind of pressure that came off the relationship when there was no expectation of me for her to be anything other than herself. That's the person that I love, rather than the person that I think she should be or should have been or could be.
That must have been a huge moment for both of you, like the pressure cooker. Like prior to that, I'm wondering what led up to that. Was she feeling like, Gary, I'm never enough for you. And you always, I do this thing and you want 10 more things. Like how did you know that that would be the right thing in that moment?
Well, I mean, it was kind of opposite for me. Yeah, it was kind of opposite. I was more like, you just need to be less this or less that. Like, you know, it was never rising up. It was more like, you know, just settle back for me. And I realized, like, I was spending my life, and this is probably one of the most common things in relationships, how much of your time you spend arguing, discussing, talking about your partner being different, right? And there's a lot of it going on, right, in little ways and big ways, like, you know, oh, you're great, but don't do this. Oh, you're awesome, but don't do that. And if you were less of this and a little bit more of that, and I like it when you're this way, but not that way. Which ultimately was all just this, you know, an ocean of judgment and opinion and expectation. It was a lot more healthy for the both of us. There was no real crescendo moment. It was really this kind of growing realization of my life about how I was having a bigger say in how this is going than I'd come to believe.
Well, I'm curious if you can, because you guys have been together a long time, over 20 years. So I'm wondering now if maybe you could give us a snapshot, if you wouldn't mind sharing them, of how it was 15 years ago or 20 years ago and how it is now. Like, how would that moment, like, what feels different right now?
I think what's very different about my wife and I's relationship is we're like every other couple, right? We don't always agree. There's certain things we come up against in life that are problematic. And none of it means anything of any great significance. So it's not like this growing concern for, how my relationship's going to turn out. Because in that time frame, what really grounded me was I'm not going anywhere. And in the background of our minds and our relationships is all too often that little noise, like something else, something better, something different, something new, something playing away. I took that away for myself. Luckily, I have the kind of wife who, she was interested in doing that work too, but it wasn't necessary really for her to do it. It wasn't like, oh yeah, you should take this on the way I'm taking it on. So it was really this growing realization that we're both human beings and that we're more interested in having this work than having this be some battleground to be fought over.
That's got to be a big moment. I want to go back to that for a minute. That we call here in LA, people always say, oh, LA is so hard because whenever you're dating someone, they're always looking for the BBD or the bigger, better deal. But even when you're in relationships committed, you're constantly going, well, if this doesn't work out, I guess there's always something else. And I'm in it, but I've only got one foot and a few other toes in. And there's always an out. And if they don't see it my way, then I'll leave. And it sounds like you had this moment where you thought, no, I'm actually moving in. Like I'm here. All my entire being is in this relationship right now. And that was a game changer for you.
Massive, because then whatever's in front of my face, like I got to deal with it, resolve it, and embolden whatever I say I want my relationship to be about. Because sometimes we get into these spots in relationships where it really just devolves into the most kind of, I mean, I can only really describe it as like toxic pettiness, where, there's just no room for anyone to be themselves anymore. And there are ways out of that, but the first way out of it is to start realizing what you're doing about that. Like how, we spend so much time looking across the table and not quite enough looking in the mirror because of that context of blame.
We've been running our whole lives, right? Probably away, a lot of us, from away from ourselves. I mean, I know I constantly am doing work, but I'm constantly peeling back layers. And something I've been working on lately is forgiveness. And I know you've talked a lot about forgiveness as well. And I always thought forgiveness was just like, okay, I forgive you and now let's move on. But there's so much to forgiveness. It's forgiving myself first and truly deeply forgiving myself for mistakes I've made or ways I wasn't present or ways I wasn't a good friend or a good lover, but also forgiving others. And that you realize that it's not just like I'm doing them a favor, that the weight of carrying anger, how much of that sucks away your life of you. So can you maybe talk about the role that that's played for you and some of your readers? Because I know you write a lot about this too and talked about it.
Yeah, I mean, the thing with forgiveness is necessary because we're so deeply wallowing in this context of blame. Like, who's to blame? I'm to blame. They're to blame. This is to blame. I'm this way because of that. They're that way because of this. It's a constant and never-ending cycle of blame. And the thing with blame is actually what keeps you rooted to the past. So it's impossible to free yourself of a past that where you continue to blame. One way to deal with that context and to deal with that kind of weight, if you like, of blame is in forgiveness and forgiving yourself, forgiving another. And sometimes, like, what we all too often do is we think that forgiveness has got something to do with approving of someone, something somebody did, or approving of what I did. It's not about approving. It's about eventually realizing that all human beings are operating out of some logic that at whatever time in their life made sense to them. And you might not agree with that. You might think that's weird. You might think that's this or that, the next thing. And it's their logic. And, I often find myself getting there, like I don't know everything that's going on in the background of every human being. Not even my wife, who, we've been partners for going on 30 years, actually. When you're in that kind of deep relationship with someone and you're still discovering them in the way that you're still discovering yourself, I mean, who am I to not forgive you? When did I become that guy? And that includes, of course, as you're pointing to, forgiving myself. I'm wired this way. I can be responsible for it. I can own it. I can manage it in a way that's really powerful. And I'm a human being too. I'm not floating around on some existential goo over here.
Yeah, we all do the best we can, right? With whatever tools we had at the moment. whatever was happening in the moment, we did the best we can with the information we had. And you got to assume that everyone else did too. But I love what you're saying, kind of the antidote to blame is forgiveness, because it's true. I know I've also done a lot of that. I blame others for a lot of things. But ultimately, I'm really hard on myself. So personally, because what this came up for me in reading your work, it was like, it was confusing because in the one hand, I don't think I'm perfect at all. I'm not somebody who always thinks I'm right. And I don't always think I'm perfect at all, but I also blame others. And then I'm really hard on myself. So it just seemed like no one's winning in my wheelhouse and no one's winning in my world. And if I'm not winning, then, you know, so then I had to do a lot of like forgiveness and healing and then just, yeah. And the blame, I'm really trying to catch myself too. Like everyone is doing the best they can. And typically if I'm so angry at other people, all roads come back to me, not in like a narcissistic way, but like, what am I doing? And it's so refreshing to know that it's like that homeostasis. When you change your behavior, people change around you too. And so there's like so much power in that.
Yeah. I think there's another piece that you have to kind of get keyed into. If you look at like, well, what if I don't forgive them? And a lot of people can say, well, I can live with it. I can live with not forgiving them. But I think if you scraped enough at that, you would see that this is not a positive thing for you. This is not like you're leaving yourself with something like resentment or anger or frustration or whatever it is, and it will manifest in other spots in your life. I think it's really important for people to ask themselves, if I keep doing what I'm doing, how does this go for me? And that very often for folks is a real place to start some truth telling on yourself. Like, what am I doing it myself by hanging on to this? Because ultimately, that's what you free yourself of, is all of that junk.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying, even if it's going back to relationships right now, because this is what we're talking about, what I'm hearing you say is like in relationships, well, they did this horrible thing 5 years ago. They lost all that money, or they had an affair. They cheated, they lied, they whatever, you know, and I never forgave him. I never forgave her for this 20 years ago. It's like, how is that going for you? Because you didn't forgive him 20 years ago. You think it's going to get better now? People think that time heals all wounds. I remember hearing that, and it doesn't. Time does not, it's not about time going past at all. And I did believe that for a while. It's more about really like forgiving, but not just because the other thing, because I know people are going to go, well, Emily, you say if someone has an affair or someone lies, you can't just rebuild trust on your own. I do believe when those things, when trust is broken, you need to go to therapy. You need to talk about it. You need to be honest. Like, you still need to do that work, but at least you have to notice what you're dealing with rather than repressing it. And then just, you're like, I'm still angry, but I'm going to be resentful because I'm getting sort of some kind of high from being angry. You know, it's all right. The destructive patterns.
Right, because sometimes people are like, the thought of breaking up is a bigger mess than it would be of sticking together. So they stick together. Like, if you've got yourself in the kind of place where you're hanging on to, let's say it was infidelity or something in your relationship, and I talk about this in the book, I say you have to realize, like, the relationship that you had with that person before that event, that relationship's over. Like, that relationship's over. That doesn't mean to say you can't create something new. But you have to realize that that's over. And you have to do the work to bring that to a state of, like, you're complete with how that went and how it rolled out. Then you might be able to say to that person, well, I want to have a relationship with you. We need to create something that's new, something that we're both up to, something that we're both interested in and getting invested in. And that includes this part in the book where I say, now you got to manage yourself moving forward. Because if that kind of shadow or that specter were to arise again for you, how are you going to manage yourself? How are you going to deal with that? Rather than just let me blame you for that, because you've said, I want to keep this thing moving in a direction where we're both together, then that's a thing called a choice. And you have to embrace the whole of the choice, not just the bits that you like the best. And that can be challenging, but I also want people to know that it's totally doable. I mean, that is a doable phenomenon. You can recreate something new out of the ashes of whatever has been, as long as you're clear about what has been is what has been. It's not the model upon which you'll base what's yet to come.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, but stick around. After a word from our sponsors, we're going to hear more from Gary all about how to improve your relationship dynamics. There's nothing quite like sinking your teeth into a good sandwich. But listen, carb guilt is real. I'm someone who's very invested in my health, and I like to get my carbs from oats and beans and fruits and not bread. But I love bread. So here's my hack. Thanks to Hero Bread, you can enjoy your favorite bready delights without the carb consequences. Hero Bread has turned those carby, empty-calorie bread products into fluffy, delicious breads that boast 0 to 1 net carbs per serving, 0 grams of sugar, and are packed with loads of fiber and protein. The first time I tried their white bread, I was skeptical. Could it really taste good with such impressive nutritional stats? Well, I'm pleasantly surprised to say it absolutely does. The texture is just phenomenal. It's like this soft, airy, and it just toasts up like a dream. I've whipped up everything from grilled cheese to PB&J and even made enchiladas, wraps, and tacos with their tortillas. Each time, Hero Bread has been a game changer. And here's the kicker. Despite its light texture and great taste, Hero Bread fits perfectly into my health goals. It's been adding more fiber to my diet while keeping the sugar at bay. Whether I'm packing a picnic lunch, planning a road trip snack, which I often do, or prepping French toast for breakfast, Hero Bread is my go-to. So whether you're craving a classic sandwich, a burger, or a hearty bun, or even indulging in a low net carb croissant, Hero Bread is something for everyone. And I highly recommend checking their monthly small batch drops out so you can try goodies like the 1 gram net carb Hero Cheddar Biscuit and so much more. You won't believe what they have. So you ready to kick carb guilt to the curb? Head over to hero.co and snag 10% off your order with the code Emily. That's Emily at hero.co. People have a new opportunity every day to recreate the relationship. And I feel like that's what your books do. They're such a wake-up call, the way that you write. And it's like, you know, you're no bullshit. I remember reading one of your first books in the airport. And it was like, okay, you know, it just gets you riled up. Like, yeah, I'm not going to take it anymore. I'm going to do it. I can change my life today, but you really can. Like, you actually really can.
Yeah.
And it starts with you.
Yeah.
You know, you could buy a book. Hopefully you will buy his book, but you need, it's really just, you have all the tools you need. And that's why I think going back to the first question is like, it starts with ourselves. And if you really want to do something different, you don't need to like study another course. You don't need to take any more drugs. There's like literally nothing else to do.
You're remarkably equipped. You are remarkably equipped for this life. Right. If you get yourself pointed in the right direction and teach yourself some fundamental things, which you can do, like something like forgiveness. Like one of the things that I'm able to do on a dime now is let go of something. And, you know, my life was never like that. My life was about hanging on to things and being determined and overcoming and using stuff as fuel and, you know, all of that. One of the reasons why I've gotten so good at it is I know what it does to me, and it's inconsistent with who I would say I fundamentally am. I may be wired a certain way, and I can be responsible for that wiring, but that is not who I am. I'll maybe feel that way in a moment, and I'll realize I refuse to live out my remaining minutes, hours, days, weeks, months, and years on this planet as that man. Like, I refuse to live that way. I will not do it. And I'd much rather live my life of being a man of compassion and joy and passion and adventure and being bold and being adventurous in this life. Because, you know, this is really not a dress rehearsal. I'm not getting ready for a later life. This is this one. And to think, you know, that at the end of my life, if I was to be left with all those moments or those times of resentment and anger and frustration and or even apathy, like I would want those moments back. I'd want them back to give them another go. So no, it's my job to remind myself, like, I don't want to be left with that at the end. I want to be left with what this at the end.
Yeah, it's such a great example there about that. Like, you were able to, in the moment, I think a lot of people, we need this skill. Like, I know if I have one more cocktail, I'm not going to feel great tomorrow, but it's really hard to stop in that moment. But what you're saying is you have a moment where you realize if I hold on to this for another day, then it's not going to serve me well. And here's what could happen. Could you maybe give us an example?
Yeah, there's tons of them. I mean, you know, like I have 3 sons and they're all soccer players. They're all very good. My middle son in particular is an elite, maybe one of the top in the country. And I go watch them play. And like any parent, your heart's in your mouth because you're watching your child do what they do. And it brings out a lot of that kind of survival-y stuff with your children, right? And maybe somebody scoops a leg away from them, or they throw an elbow in their face or something. And you're like, and I've caught myself so many times, like shouting something at, and then somebody will say something. I just look and I know what happened. And I know that what I saw was accurate and la, la, la. And I just go, okay.
So just okay.
So I'll just, okay. All right. Like I'm not going to go there. I'm not going to sit here and watch this game in a fit of anger or resentment. Like I'll let it go. And it's the same even with my children. Like, you know, because again, a lot of it's like survival. It's stuff that comes to the surface when you're at your kind of lowest moments, especially with stuff like anger and frustration. Like those are definitely very much keyed into those kind of survival elements. And it's always some kind of threat, some threat to you or some kind of threat to those around you or a threat to your situation. It's always some kind of perceived threat. You know, I always go back to Sartre in those moments. I always go back to like, this just doesn't mean what's going on in my head is making it mean. It's just not, it doesn't mean that. This is just somebody doing what they do and it's okay. I think I'll survive.
Right. It's that fight or flight. I mean, and the problem is with fight or flight. And what we're talking about here to slow down is that we often, the things that we do that are so destructive are a reaction that is so quick that we don't even realize we're doing it. And so to be able to just be able, having the power of the presence and mindfulness to stop yourself in that moment and say, okay, right. I can breathe. Right. Like for me, I breathe. Sometimes I literally bite my tongue. Like I literally.
Well, I think it's two things. I think there's catching yourself in the moment. And I actually like what you do when you bite your tongue because it makes you present. You have to get present. So you're present to that physical thing that you do rather than caught up in that train of thought that's in your head. Sometimes people breathe, other people stand up and go for a walk. There's a lot of things you can do. Physical interruption to it is important. But the other aspect that I say to people is, you know, it's not the end of the world if it, you know, if that brain pattern goes and off you trail after. The question then becomes is, are you big enough to deal with the impact of that? Are you big enough to clean up your mess, including with yourself? And go back, going back to that thing of forgiving yourself. I'm not asking people to be robots or to be perfect. I'm saying to people, you know, with the right kind of work and the right kind of attention, you can really change a life in a really spectacular way. And it's all doable for everybody. It's not like you're some special case that no one's ever been able to crack. There's stuff out there you can do and utilize to empower yourself.
So true. You must have, all of your listeners from all these years, you must have heard from some people who have take your work and make it their own. Is there any common steps that you've noticed people taking? I'm even hearing people just maybe starting on the journey of, okay, I'm going to forgive myself, but I'm still angry. Like, what are some ways that you found have been, any stories that come to mind, perhaps?
Well, I mean, lots of them. But a common theme for people is realizing that no one was coming to save them and no one was going to come and make you happier. Right? Like being happy is actually your job. And you got to stop waiting for things to change to be happy. Or you got to stop waiting for you to be different so that you can be happy. Because those pursuits are generally very internal. You're looking in the way, am I happy yet? Am I happy yet? Which is a question one can't really ask yourself if you're happy, right?
No.
A key one I see across the board is people start to really take on that if they were going to live a happy life, it was up to them. So that was a big thing. And then a second one that definitely comes up frequently is where people start to realize like these persistent kind of emotional states in their life, whether they're apathetic or they're suppressed or they're frustrated or whatever your thing is, people noticing that it was a lot less to do what was going on around them and way more to do with their reaction to what was going on around them. And if you can start to see some of those like responses you're having to life as it's happening, you're really on the right path to starting to get like, all right, life's happening. And then there's my experience of life happening. And your experience of life happening is all down to you. It's not what's going on around you. It's all your experience of it. That's why it's so different for each of us.
Yeah, your interpretation. So what you're saying is too, realizing that we are responsible, but then also our interpretation of events. We also are narrating that along with, you know, we get to decide. It doesn't have to mean anything. It could also mean nothing. You could also let go. Those are huge moments.
Yeah. Yeah, and the interesting thing for me, I guess, is the variation on all of those themes. Like, you can have two people have the exact same childhood or very similar and come out of it with just a whole different narrative.
Siblings.
And you end up living the life of your narrative, not the life of your past. And that narrative is so ingrained with you that you can't tell the difference between the narrative and the past. They both seem like they're the same thing to you in your head. And that's why we end up, like you're talking about siblings, you know, siblings will disagree as adults about what happened in their childhood. And the reality is, inside both of those narratives, they're both accurate.
So true. I know, I did with my brother. It's like, did we grow up in different homes? But you're so right too to say, they're both right. You're both right. Mom was this way. It's all true. But then to be able to go to extrapolate and said, well, then what narrative am I creating right now? But the first thing you said is so interesting about, like, something I'm always saying on the show to people, to my listeners, is you are responsible for your own pleasure. Your partner's not responsible. They're not going to show up one day and know how to be the best lover to you and the best partner to you. So why, and you talk a lot about this in your book too, like, why do you think we make our partners responsible for things that we really should be in charge of in our life, like personal fulfillment and happiness or even sexual pleasure? But why is that our thing? We all do it.
Some of the world's greatest philosophers were interested in this, but why do we do what we do? Why do we seek to blame others? Why do we seek for others to influence us? And for me, it seems like there's this kind of avoidance of being on the hook for something. And this avoidance of being like being seen to be on the hook for something. So as human beings, we're very much looking for situations to influence us, looking for a situation or a circumstance that'll make me feel better. Without ever really paying attention to what's going on, you're literally making yourself feel better, right? You're literally doing that in a moment. Whenever you say to somebody, you know, I love when you do that thing, you know, I just feel so loved. They're not doing anything. You're having that experience of love yourself. You're generating that. You're bringing that to the fore. You're making that present for yourself. You're doing all of that. I think part of the struggle we have is we don't realize that that's what's happening. It seems like it's being done unto us. Therefore, we go on this pursuit of seeking. I like what you said, you know, be responsible for your own pleasure. But that includes, you know, stuff like your own joy and your own sense of self and your own ambition and your own sense of confidence and self-expression and all of those items. You're an expression machine, for the love of God. And, you know, I want people to really get, like, you know, you have the ability to shift yourself in any moment of time. And once you realize that you are, in fact, in charge of this thing, like, nobody's doing this without you.
I think that when we realize that, the more we do notice when our partners are doing the right thing, the thing that makes us feel good, to tell them. What I've realized is the more I reinforce things and say, I really enjoy that. That felt really good the way that you kissed me when you came home from work. Or I love the way you touched my neck. That meant a lot that you asked about my day. It made me feel so seen by you. That the more we do that to our partners and we reinforce that stuff, especially if you're someone who leans towards blaming and shaming our partners all the time, I would say try for a week even. I was going to say a month, but then it's a month too much. So for a week, when you are thinking of criticizing them, just try to switch it. And you can even pre-write at the top of the week. These are the 10 things I want to say to them. Because that's going to rewire your brain too. But not only it's going to rewire your way of looking at your partner, but it's all connected. You actually felt good in the moment. And by voicing that and praising your partner for that or sharing your experience, you're going to get more of that rather than the blaming and shaming, which gets you nowhere.
Right. I think there's a quote, I can't remember whether it's in this book or another book, but I said, you know, you have to be obvious about your love. You can't be vague about it. And you can't be sitting there like hoping that someone will step up and love you the way you want to be loved. And then being in a partnership with someone sometimes means that they don't always do it in an obvious way, or they don't always love you in a way or express themselves in a way that even you might like. But that is a big part of the dance. A big part of the dance with another human being is finally coming to terms with that this is a human being, not some, you know, something out of a movie or a book or something you saw somebody else in a relationship with. This is an actual living person with a past and their stuff and their stresses and their strains and their survival and their all of that stuff. And then you start to get like a little bit more related to it, I guess. more like in the realm of the cosmos, like two beings just making their way through this life and trying to work it out.
It's like that Ram Dass quote, like we're all just walking each other home, right? Yeah. It's so true. Yeah. Like we're all just sort of in it together. We all have, not only do we have our traumas, but we talk about ancestral trauma now that they say go back 7-8 generations. So if you're with somebody, that's like 16 generations of trauma. Good luck. You know, you might as well realize that you are in this together. You are walking each other home. Can you talk more about identity relationships? What are those and why we get into identity relationships?
Yeah. All right. Well, it's a little opaque at the beginning, so you have to kind of bear with me, but we're mostly subconscious beings. We're not conscious. We're just not conscious, right? We're mostly working on an autopilot. You go through your life reacting and responding to things in a way that you always do. And it's the same in relationship. So if you try on the idea that there's something about you, each of us as human beings, like a little hole, a little gap, a little space that we're never quite okay with, we're never quite settled with. And it could be something simple like, you know, I'm not good enough, I'm not smart enough, I'm not lovable, no one really cares. And we make our way through life. These aren't big deal breakers, these aren't big massive things in our mind, but they're there. And we're living a life and those things occasionally come up. Sometimes in certain areas of our lives, they become more exacerbated. So I invite people to try on in this book. I say, try on the idea that your partner is actually chosen by you to highlight that. And so this is someone that you can go into this relationship with, that thing will consistently come up for you and you'll have to keep overcoming it and overcoming it and overcoming it. How do you overcome it? You overcome it by being the you that you've become. You overcome it by becoming this more of this identity that you are. So you'll double down on all of that. All the while, that little gap never quite gets filled. Now, the problem is, of course, that that's the same for your partner. And that's all too often two people trying to work something out, but their own, in the background of their own thoughts, in the foreground of their relationship. And believe it or not, what people would call a match made in heaven is all too often a match made in hell, because it really is more about what's in the background for both people, even though they might be engrossed and seduced by what's in the foreground. It's way more about what's going on in the background for both people. And in a relationship, as they really start to uncover and get to know each other, it becomes more and more, and it rises more and more to the surface and becomes a massive bone of contention.
For example, I'm just going to go off the first thing you said, and it's also relatable, saying like, I'm not smart enough. So you're saying, let's say that's my hole, that's my gap. Like, I'm a great person, I give back, I'm good with my family and my kids and my life and my friends, I'm a good citizen, I'm a good boss, but I ultimately feel like I'm not doing enough. Maybe that's my thing. Like, I'm just never can quite do enough. What I'm doing is wrong. So you're saying I might be attracted to somebody who is constantly reinforcing that I am not doing enough.
Now, I wouldn't say that they're actively
not on purpose. It's not active.
You're consciously getting reminded of it.
Right, through them. I'm getting triggered.
Yeah.
But maybe the flip side of that is they help fill me in ways that I need to be filled. We're talking this is subconscious, right? My whole thing is that I don't feel good enough. So I'm falling in love with someone. I'm like, oh, I feel so loved by them. I feel so held. So because initially you do feel great, but what you realize is that this is so nuanced, but some of the things they're doing that make me feel whole is probably a numbing. It's probably they're using words that make me feel enough, but they actually are doing stuff that's kind of destructive. Or maybe they're doing a lot of actions that are good, but their words are, you know, so it's confusing. Ultimately, it just means I haven't done enough work on myself yet.
Right. Here's what I would invite you to try to say.
Example.
Yeah. At the beginning of a relationship, it's very much in that attraction stage, you know, like you're attracted to this person. Maybe physically, maybe intellectually, maybe emotionally, maybe circumstantially attracted to this person. And in those initial stages, whatever way they are is usually the solution to what you're trying to overcome. Yeah. So whatever way they are, like, oh, that's why people say this is the one, right? Like there could only be one in a planet of 8 billion. But anyway, you know, it's kind of like you're looking at this person and it's like that issue, that thing with you, is solved.
It feels soft. Well, that's the flip. This is not my issue here. I'm just saying in general, though, just so we all know, I figured a lot of stuff, but we're saying, so that's the flip side of the identity relationships is that you feel like it's solved. Okay, got it. So let's go with that. So you feel like it's solved. Yeah.
Right. And then you get into it and you realize it's actually not solved. And that thing is still there. But now, because you're in a relationship, and a relationship tends to grind all of your incomplete junk to the surface. Okay, that's just how that is. The more your guard goes down, the more you kind of let some of that stuff up, it all comes, you know, falling out of our mouths. Then you'll start to see, man, this thing is not going anywhere. I don't feel this anymore. Then this solution that you once looked at is now the obstacle. This is now the problem. Like, this was the solution at once upon a time. Now it's the problem. And, you know, that's why I insist in the book, you know, you really like working on yourself and coming to terms with yourself and really digging into some of the dirt is so critical when it comes to actually having an authentic, real, genuine, grown-up relationship with another human being rather than some regurgitated upsets from your past.
One of your books is Do the Work. But when we say do the work, I want to drive this home, like, and I hate that it's work, because we're talking about the work is going to set you free. But where do we start on the path? Let's say we haven't done any work yet. What is do the work? Can you give us a little bit?
I always like to make things very simple for people. The work itself can be layered and complex, but the pathway has to be simple. And the first thing I ask people is, okay, well, just pick at some part of your life that you feel as if isn't working for you right now. Start there. Like, what is it? Specifically, what doesn't work for you? And you might say, well, relationships don't work for me. Well, what kind of relationships? And what has been the issue? What have been the problems? And then if you set aside all of the nonsense, like about, you know, why your relationships might have ended, which people can explain to you ad nauseum, right? Like just layers and layers of why relationships don't work. I say, well, who were you in it? If you tell yourself the truth, who were you? I had a conversation with somebody recently, and it was very revealing to them, but who they were in relationships was independent and cynical.
Yeah.
Right. Now, that's not a great recipe, right, for love. Like, I'm independent and cynical. No, they were hopeful. They wanted things to work. They wanted to meet the right person. They wanted love. They wanted all these things. Like, but if you actually just got down to basics of the way they operated in the day-to-day life of their relationship, they saw that they were independent and cynical. Mm-hmm. And I asked this person a really simple question. I said, when did that start? Like, forget love. Just tell me, when did you start being really independent and cynical? And they tracked all the way back to a situation from a childhood when you had this experience and la, 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 la. And they got stuck in that path and could not get themselves out of it because they were spending so much time looking around without paying attention to who was walking the path. And so that's often surprising for people. Like, people will say stuff like, I'm too this way in relationships, or I'm too that way, and this is why it doesn't work, and people take advantage of me. I'm like, no, that is not what you're looking for. You got to go three layers down on that. Those are great places to start, though. In love relationships and familial relationships, a great place to start to see some of the turns you've taken as a human being.
So true. We have to go back to that. I always joke, and this is not to knock moms, but it's not, if it's not one thing, it's your mother. But if it's not one thing, it could also be your father. It's your childhood, and your parents did the best they can. They loved you to the best of their ability. Your parents are not bad or wrong. They're humans just like you. However, there's a lot of great information in your childhood.
There is. The other thing that I want to give people is, and I say this consistently to people, your life wouldn't be different if your childhood was different. And they're like, oh my gosh, no, totally, Dean, if that never happened, this would never happen. And I know and understand that, and I get the logic of that, the reasoning of that. But human beings are by nature designed to create a disconnect with their parents at some point in their life. Why? So that they can then justify going off on their own pathway. So at some point in your life, whether you realize it or not, you are wired to make your parents wrong for the job they did. That's how that rolls. And the quicker you realize that and see it, yeah, the quicker you see that, the better for you. You know, the more you start to see, like, it's less to do with you and more to do with the, you know, like, the existence of human beings on the planet.
Yeah, it's something we have to go through, the disassociation from our parents, and some people never come back to it, right? I know that was your experience with your mom, Gary. Well, we only have a few more minutes. Gary, thank you so much for being here. I need to now ask you the five questions. They're quickie questions, so you don't have to think about them too much, that we ask all of our guests, okay?
Sure.
Sure, quickie. Ready? Okay. And this can be anything. Here we go. What's your biggest turn on?
My wife.
Biggest turn off?
People being inconsiderate.
What makes good sex?
Adventure.
I love it. Something you would tell your younger self about sex and relationships.
It's not as heavy and significant as you think it is. It's an opportunity to go play.
What's the number one thing you wish everyone knew about sex?
That it's okay to be yourself.
Thank you, Gary. Those are great, great answers. I so appreciate you. Thank you so much. Best of luck on your book and on your journey here. And thank you so much for spending time with us
today. Thanks for having me. Great to be in this conversation with you. Awesome.
Yeah, it was really good. Awesome. Thanks, Gary.
Thanks, Mike.
Have a great night. That's it for today's episode. See you on Friday. Thanks for listening to Sex with Emily. Be sure to like, subscribe, and give us a review wherever you listen to the podcast, and share this with a friend or partner. You can find me on YouTube, Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Sex with Emily. Oh, I've been told I give really good email. So sign up at sexwithemily.com. And while you're there, check out my free guides and articles for more ways to prioritize your pleasure. If you'd like to ask me about your sex life, dating, or relationships, call my hotline, 559-TALK-SEX. That's 559-825-5739. Or go to sexwithemily.com/askemily. Special thanks to Acast for powering the Sex with Emily podcast. Was it good for you? Email me, feedback@sexwithemily.com.